Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
It was kind of profounder than that. It was realizing the reality of a world in which the cross serves as a symbol of the power of the powerful to torture and torment and kill the powerless. When instinctively, to me, as someone who'd grown up in a fundamentally Christian society, the cross served as the opposite.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable as 2021 turns into 2022. A very happy new year to you, and something rather different and special for you today, a lecture by historian Tom Holland on Christianity, persecution and the cross. Thank you so much for listening throughout the year to Unbelievable, as well as our regular radio audience. We've had over 4 million downloads of Unbelievable across the past year on podcast, and millions of views as well on our YouTube channel. In fact, we recently surpassed 150,000 subscribers on YouTube. Now, that certainly doesn't make us the biggest fish in the YouTube pond, but I am really pleased to see how many people are engaging across all of these different platforms with the show. So thank you. And our other podcasts from Premier Unbelievable, the Ask NT Wright Anything and the C.S. Lewis podcast, continued to grow in the past year. Ask NT Wright Anything had over 2 million downloads. And our newest podcast, the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, over a quarter of a million downloads. So thank you for engaging with all of the material we've been bringing you. And later on in the show, I'm going to give you a rundown of our most popular Unbelievable shows from the past year. See what you were listening to the most. Now, I wonder what you'd like to see in 2022. Please do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or let me know on social media what you would like to see on the show in terms of topics, in terms of guests. I always start the year asking people to tell me what they'd like to see on the show. So if you'd like to do that, do get in touch. Again, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch on our Facebook page, facebook.com/premierunbelievable. You can tweet me at unbelievablejb. We've also got a poll open on what you'd like to see in our Big Conversation Season 4 for 2022. You'll get a free ebook if you complete that. Check the links with today's show to fill out our survey for the Big Conversation Season 4. Now, as we come to the end of the year, it's a time when many people give to causes they believe in, and we're running an end-of-year giving appeal for Unbelievable. We are a listener-supported show. If you're able to give and take us strong into 2022, that would be really appreciated. If you're listening via podcast, you can find a link with today's show. Just click the link that applies to where you are in the world, and we really do appreciate every gift to help support us. So on to today's show. Tom Holland is a well-known historian and author of best-selling works such as Rubicon, Dynasty and In the Shadow of the Sword. He's been a guest several times now on Unbelievable over the last few years. Since the publication of his book Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World, he's been increasingly addressing why Christianity matters and what may happen globally in its absence. The lecture you're about to hear, Invisible Fire, was recorded at the British Library for Open Doors, a charity supporting persecuted Christians around the world. It was the first of their Perspectives lectures. I was there, and it was great to see so many turning out who wanted to hear Tom speak on these issues. So we're grateful for permission to rebroadcast it here on Unbelievable. And introducing the lecture is Open Doors UK and Ireland CEO, Henrietta Blythe.
At Open Doors, we passionately believe that we must strengthen the church in the face of persecution, which is increasing all the time, because a world without Christians would be a far worse place. And that's really what these perspective lectures are about. We want to explain why that is the case. And we want all of you to be able to explain why that is the case as well. And that's why I am so thrilled to introduce Tom Holland as our guest speaker tonight. Tom is a historian of antiquity. Actually, I just asked Tom how he wanted me to describe him, and he just said, just say that I'm lovely. So, you are lovely, Tom. I can tell that. But he is also, let me tell you, a historian of antiquity. He writes and speaks on a wide range of subjects, including classical and medieval history, Greece and Rome especially, the origins of Islam, Christianity, and secularism, and I understand cricket. Most importantly for us, Tom is helping both Christians and non-Christians to appreciate the historical role that Christian faith has had and continues to have in shaping society. His work is both an education and an encouragement. As Christians in the midst of a battle for truth which rages all around us, it's really important that we know our history. Because the battle that is raging today is about yesterday, and it will shape the world we live in tomorrow. I very much look forward to hearing what you've got to say to us tonight, Tom. Thank you for being with us. After Tom's talk, there will be an opportunity for questions and answers for Q&A, so please do make a mental note of how to put him on the spot. And ladies and gentlemen, I give you Tom Holland.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I'm very embarrassed I described myself as lovely. That would definitely have come as news to my daughter, who I shouted at before leaving this afternoon because she'd forgotten to give me back my key. I'd also like to thank you all for the invitation to come and talk here and for coming out this evening. And I would like to thank you for all the work that you do. And I would like to talk about how the work that you do and the world that you are concerned with, I'd like to say the impact that it's had on me personally. Because I've been asked in this talk, and I will quote, to talk about how can Christians in the West de-Westernize and how can Westerners re-Christianize? Well, you don't need me to tell you that an obvious way for Christians in the West to de-Westernize is to think about Christians in lands beyond the West, to think about the insights that they may have to offer, the lives that they may lead, the perspectives on Christianity that they may be able to offer you, us. But on the topic of how can Westerners re-Christianize, the same is true. Westerners who may not be Christian can look to Christians beyond the West and discover how Christian perhaps they are in ways that they had not properly appreciated. And I know that that is the case because that is absolutely what happened to me. And one of the excitements of being here tonight is that in the presence of such an audience as is here, that I can talk about this perhaps more personally than I have done before. I'm going to put my hands up and say that I have talked on this theme quite a lot over the years since Dominion came out. But I haven't been given an opportunity, perhaps, to talk about exactly the impact that contemplating the persecution of Christians and of others in lands plagued by war, sectarianism and violence, talk about the impact that it had on me personally and on the process of writing Dominion. And I'm not a brave person. I'm sure most of you must be. You must go out there, you must have dealings with lands, with regimes, with people suffering terrible things. I'm much more of a wuss. And so it was with some trepidation in 2016 that I signed up to make a documentary for Channel 4 about the Islamic State, and specifically about why it was that the Islamic State were targeting religious minorities for persecution. So we flew out to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan, and the first place we visited was this monastery here, the monastery of Marmatai, which, you know, some of you may have been there, some of you may even have met Father Yusuf, who is standing there gazing out at what is the plain of Nineveh. So Mosul is in the distance. And this is literally, in 2016, the edge of the Islamic State. The Islamic State had moved into northern Iraq in 2014, had conquered Mosul, and this monastery is like a kind of sparrow's nest, starling's nest, kind of built, a swallow's nest, built on under the eaves. It kind of clings to the side of the mountain. So that landscape that you're looking out at, that is the Islamic State. And to be there, gazing out at this terrifying caliphate, and listen to this man who had become a monk in this very, very ancient monastery, going back, it said, to the 4th century, brought alive all kinds of Christian teachings, Christian modes of life that previously had been perhaps rather antiseptic to me. Father Yusuf had been born, grown up in Mosul. He was the younger of two sons. And he told me the story of his elder brother that he had married. He'd had children. And he, Father Yusuf, had become a monk. And he said, I was very proud of my devotion to Christ. I felt a kind of arrogance that I had committed myself to Christ in the way that my brother hadn't. And then his brother had been killed in a sectarian attack in Mosul, and his wife and his children had been left without anyone, without a man to look after them, which was very important in Mosul. And so Father Yusuf had taken charge of them, and he said that he felt that this was God's way of reminding him not to be arrogant, not to be pleased with himself, not to be smug in his sense of his own holiness. And this is the kind of story that, standing there in this ancient monastery in a place of such peril, had the kind of impact of a parable on me. I'd never heard a Christian tell a story that kind of rang so profoundly for me. But of course, the sectarian killing of his brother was the least of it, because then, as I said, 2014, Islamic State came up and the entire Christian population of Mosul basically fled. And the monks at Marmatai put them up. And they spent, you know, when we got there, the frontier had stabilized, but they'd basically spent 2 years facing the prospect that the Islamic State might get up the side of the hill, might get to them. And they all knew then what their fate would be. And when the father took me round the monastery and he talked about the persecutions that they'd suffered at the hands of pagan kings and Muslim caliphs and Mongol conquerors, they all seemed to blur and shimmer and become one with the sense of dread that hung over this landscape, and you can see the smoke rising up from a drone strike in the distance. And the themes of Christian history, the cycles of persecution and of faith seemed vivid in a way that they simply hadn't done before. But that wasn't the most vivid experience that I had. From Marmatai, this monastery, we went to another site, also on the frontier, literally on the frontier. But there was no monastery there. So this is the road that leads down to a town called Sinjar. Again, I'm sure most of you will know what happened in Sinjar, for those of you who may not. Sinjar as well was occupied by the Islamic State. It had been recaptured by the Kurds just, I think, a few weeks before we got there. We were the second group of Western journalists who got into Sinjar after it's recaptured by the Kurds. But again, the Islamic State were kind of a mile or so beyond, within mortar range. So kind of very much, we were very, very much on the front line. And you can see that, this was the entire town had been gutted. It was in complete ruins. This road had been cleared, but many hadn't. There were mines everywhere, the bits of bodies still lying there. Not a pleasant place at all. And there was a church here that had been systematically desecrated. So this is the altar. You can see, it's a solid structure. And the Islamic State had brought in power drills to demolish it. There's the font being smashed. You can see there's a mine there. And all across the floor, there were icons that have been trodden down, smashed. As in Marmatai, where the sense of persecution that hung over the monks there was put in perspective by the cycles of persecution that had preceded it over the centuries. So also here, this was a church that had been built by refugees from the Armenian genocide. Christians had built this church thinking that they were safe and had been forced to flee. But terrible though the sufferings of Christians in Mosul and in Sinjar had been, they were not as terrible as the sufferings of another religious minority, the Yazidis. And just as in Nazi Germany, where you'd have Stars of David put up outside Jewish houses, this is indicating that this is a Yazidi house, and you can see the fate. It's been exploded, burnt, gutted, destroyed. And the Yazidis suffered even worse persecution than the Christians, because Christians, of course, in the Quran, named as a people of the book, and therefore the Islamic State, obedient to the dictates of the Quran, at least had to offer some measure of toleration to Christians, but none was offered to Yazidis, who were categorized by the Islamic State not just as pagans, but as worshippers of the devil. And therefore, the fate visited on the Yazidis was truly terrible. Women, girls as young as 8, rounded up, those held to be attractive enough to become sex slaves, sold into slavery. Those who weren't, shot, dumped, abandoned, and we got taken out to see their skeletons, their bones, their hair, their clothing, littered out in the fields, in the dead zone between the Kurdish front line and the Islamic State positions. So slavery of women, and many of the men who'd been butchered, many of those men had been crucified. They'd been crucified in this town where I was. And as been said, my background is preeminently in classical antiquity, specifically in Rome. And of course, when the Romans took a city, they would enslave the women and they would crucify the men and slaughter them. And this was something that I had understood in the abstract since, from a very early age, from when I was a child and I first got my obsession with ancient Rome. And my obsession with Rome was born partly with Asterix, which, you know, if you trust Asterix, Julius Caesar conquers the whole of Gaul without killing anyone. The only worst that can happen is you might end up in a tree with stars going around your head. But of course, even then, I knew that this wasn't true because I had this book, and this illustrates the Siege of Alesia, Caesar's greatest, most extraordinary victory, where he defeats a vast army of Gauls. And the sufferings that the Romans inflicted on Gaul over the course of Caesar's conquest were kind of beyond computation. Caesar crucified, Caesar enslaved, Caesar chopped the hands off of people who resisted him. Plutarch, writing a century or so later, says, maybe exaggerating but not too much, that Caesar slaughtered a million Gauls and enslaved another million. And I kind of knew that, but to me it just seemed, wow, Caesar was really cool. Rome, the legions are, you know, wow, love them. And in kind of seeing Caesar and his legions in that light, I was behaving as the Romans themselves had done. Because when Caesar, in due course, triumphs in the civil wars, goes to Rome, conducts his Gallic triumphs, you know, a great celebration of his military victories, treasure and prisoners march through the streets of Rome. Placards are also taken on which Caesar boasts how many people he's killed, how many slaves he's taken. So things that to us might seem reprehensible, to him were a cause, I mean, of literal triumph. And I think that it's possible to spend your whole life studying the Romans and kind of never breathe in the dust of a town where people have been crucified. But when I did, I felt ashamed at the lack of imagination, the lack of kind of historical empathy that I'd shown, and also the lack of curiosity that I'd shown in not wondering what it was that had changed since the time of Caesar and the time in which I was standing. You know, why was it that when I stood in Sinjar and thought, people have been crucified here, people have been put up on crosses in the burning sun and left like chunks of meat, to the Islamic State, these crosses served as symbols of their power. And that is what crosses served, that's what they were to the Romans as well. We have very few descriptions of crucifixion in Roman literature. We have the Gospels, of course, but very little else, and we have very little physical evidence of what it was. And one of the reasons for this is that the Romans themselves seem to have been so revolted by crucifixion that they didn't like to dwell on it. But this is something that I think gives a flavour. It's one of two physical remains from someone who suffered death by crucifixion. You can see the nail has been driven into the ankle bone, found in a grave outside Jerusalem. And when we think about crucifixion and we try and see it through Roman eyes, we don't want to try and repress the knowledge of this. We need to foreground it, because the suffering and the agony and above all the humiliation of it was precisely the point. Crucifixion was a fate that was visited on those who were regarded by the Romans as the lowest of the low. People who were rebels against the power of Caesar in the provinces, or even worse, slaves who were rebels against their masters. And the reason that crucifixion was seen as paradigmatically the fate that should be visited on slaves was that you didn't just suffer physical agony. It wasn't just that it was protracted, lasting perhaps hours, perhaps days. It's also the fact that it was public. Your sufferings in a society where to be humiliated, to be shamed was absolutely the worst of fates, your sufferings were visible to everyone. People could gather and point and laugh as birds flocked around your head to peck out your eyes, as you gasped and heaved, hauling yourself up and down, feeling the nail scrape against the bone as you did so. Your agony would be a cause of mockery. And so the body of a crucified slave, of a crucified rebel against Rome, hanging from a cross, served the Romans as a kind of billboard, advertising their power, advertising their authority, advertising their, not just their right, but their duty to impose incredible suffering on anyone who dared to resist them. And standing in Sinjar, I realised that the sense of an existential abyss that I was feeling wasn't just my sense of dread and terror that I was kind of close to people who had done this. It was kind of profounder than that. It was realizing the reality of a world in which the cross serves as a symbol of the power of the powerful to torture and torment and kill the powerless. When instinctively, to me, as someone who'd grown up in a fundamentally Christian society, the cross served as the opposite. The cross served as a reassurance that actually it's the powerless who triumphs over the powerful. It's the slave who triumphs over the master. It's the man sentenced to the cross who triumphs over the apparatus of the state that has sentenced him.
You're listening to the Unbelievable New Year Special, Tom Holland's lecture on Christianity, Persecution and the Cross, given at the British Library in November. And we'll hear its continuation in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to our New Year show from Unbelievable, picking up again this lecture with Tom Holland on Christianity, Persecution and the Cross, given for Open Doors earlier in the year in London.
And we have to think ourselves into the sandals of the Romans, I guess, to understand and properly appreciate just how unfathomably weird it is that today the cross, of all things, should be perhaps the most instantly recognisable cultural symbol that any human culture has developed, and that it symbolises not power, but kind of the opposite, that the victim will triumph. And we have to feel how weird that is in the way that Paul did. Our earliest evidence for this, Paul writing about the cross, says that to the Gentiles, to the Romans, saying that somebody who in some strange way is part of the divine suffered crucifixion, that this is likely to seem madness. It's not the idea that a man, you know, can become a god that was kind of weird to the Romans. They entirely accepted that. Paul was travelling around a world in which the fastest growing cult, you know, it wasn't Christianity, it was the cult of Augustus Caesar, who was the adoptive son of Julius Caesar, so the son of a god, a man who had brought peace to the earth, who had then ascended to heaven to sit at the right hand of his father. This was the fastest growing cult. It wasn't weird that a man could become a god. But what was weird was the idea that somebody who'd suffered this death, of all deaths, that he was in some way divine. That was the madness of it. And I think when you read Paul's letters, you feel the sense of the kind of Paul's, I mean, there are points where he feels almost embarrassed about it. And he's never less than kind of stupefied with a sense of wonder at what he's saying, at what has been revealed to him, that he preaches Christ crucified. It seems mad But this is what happened, he says. And I think over the years that follow, the years and the centuries, that sense of embarrassment never quite goes away. You know, Christians, of course, believe that their Messiah suffered death on the cross. But, you know, right the way through the first century, into the second century, this sense of slight embarrassment about it. And even when in the fourth century, Constantine converts, after, of course, seeing a sign of the cross in the sky, and the Roman Empire starts to become Christian, still this lingering sense of embarrassment, which is why you tend not to get portrayals of the cross. Until the beginning of the 5th century, you do, and this is one of the earliest. It's in the British Museum, so you can go and see it. It's just around the corner from the Sutton Hoo helmet, and it's an ivory casket showing the details of the Passion, and this, of course, is Jesus on the cross. But what you will immediately notice is that this does not look like a man who is suffering unbearable agony. This looks like a man who is on Love Island or something. He is kind of buff, honed, wearing a skimpy loincloth. Basically, he looks like, you know, he's not a contestant on Love Island. He's an athlete. He's someone who's won the great race of life. And this sense that Christ on the cross is kind of serene, that he is a conqueror, is something that endures, particularly in the Byzantine tradition, in the other churches of the East as well. But in the West, it becomes slightly different. And it's the West goes on a slightly different course, because in the West, there does become to be an increasing focus on the sufferings of Christ. But even so, it's not until the year 1000, so kind of 600 years after that previous casket, that someone actually portrays Christ as dead on the cross. So this is around the year 1000. It's a chapel in Cologne Cathedral. And from that point on, really, the sufferings of Christ becomes one of the great focuses of medieval Christian piety, evident in prayers, in devotions, in theology, and of course in the art. And here you feel people really are engaging with what the reality of crucifixion might have been. And I think it's possible that this has had, that we've kind of become culturally desensitized to it. That in a sense, people in the Middle Ages were forcing themselves to stare into the reality of what their saviour had suffered in a way that was constantly kind of probing the agony of it, the pain of it. People wanted to feel it in its intensest form. But then having done that, almost it's as though the cross just became a symbol in which the reality of it came to be forgotten. But I'm not sure actually that that's entirely true, because take a look at the modern thinker who I think has most profoundly contemplated the significance of the cross, and who in a way is a kind of mirror image to Paul in his kind of wonder and embarrassment at it. Paul, of course, had seen a vision of the risen Christ. Friedrich Nietzsche despised Christianity, detested it, hated it. And he hated it for the same reason that Paul was awestruck by it. The vision of Christ on the cross, the horror of it, Nietzsche wrote, to devise something which could even approach the seductive, intoxicating, anesthetizing and corrupting power of that symbol of the Holy Cross, that horrific paradox of the crucified God, that mystery of an inconceivably ultimate, most extreme cruelty and self-crucifixion undertaken for the salvation of mankind. And Nietzsche was appalled by it because he believed, no matter what the appearance might be, no matter what free thinkers in the rest of Europe and the West might think, he believed that Europe remained utterly enthralled to the implications and the reverberations of the crucifixion. He believed that socialists, communists, liberals, humanists. Particular objects of his contempt were English upper middle class agnostics. He regarded them all as kind of ersatz Christians, Christians who refused to acknowledge that they were Christian, and people who may well believe that they had repudiated institutional Christianity, but with their commitment to helping the weak, helping the poor, helping the suffering, were simply demonstrating how much they remained the slaves of this slave religion. And Nietzsche despised it all, and he looked forward to a time when people would realise the proper implications of the fact that God was dead. That without Christian faith, you can't ultimately have Christian belief. And Nietzsche foretold that a time would come when there would be a great day of reckoning, and great deeds of horror and blood would be performed, and everything would be transformed. Of course, what he did not know was what was going to happen in the 20s and the 30s with the rise of fascism. And fascism, unlike the French Revolution, unlike the Russian Revolution, had as its object of hatred not just institutional Christianity, but its core doctrines. And in particular, the doctrines perhaps that were focused for Paul in the cross, in the crucifixion and the resurrection. The idea that Christ has suffered on the cross for everybody, for Jew and Greek, for man and woman, for slave and free, and that all shared in the same essential dignity. That there was a common dignity that all human beings shared. The Nazis obviously totally rejected that. The Nazis completely thought that there was Jews and there were Greeks and that they were different. And of course, the Nazis repudiated the idea that there was strength in weakness and dignity in the lack of dignity. And they believed that the weak should be crushed and snuffed out and annihilated, not because they thought that they were doing wrong or evil, but because they thought that was the right thing to do. And we, today, I think, perhaps in the West, live in the shadow less of the crucifixion than we do of the Holocaust. That the horror of what the Nazis did is more vivid, perhaps, in the imaginings than anything that in the West the church can teach. Hitler is a more potent figure than the devil. Auschwitz haunts our imaginings more terribly than hell. Nazi is the ultimate insult rather than heretic or evildoer or whatever. And you may think, well, that reflects the fading of Christianity, the decline of Christianity. Perhaps in one sense it does, but I think in another sense, very profound sense, it doesn't. Because Nietzsche, in his famous parable of the death of God, talks of the corpse of God being of an enormous size and filling a cave and spilling shadows on the cave. And in a sense, the way that the Nazis haunt the imaginings of the West is like the shadows of the corpse of God on the cave. We regard the Nazis as evil because our standards of good and evil remain profoundly, profoundly Christian. The Nazis shock us because they trampled on 2,000 years of Christian teaching. And that's the reason for the horror. So I think that if Westerners are to be re-Christianized, I think we need to be reminded that our values, not even our values, our instincts, our gut instincts, are deeply, deeply rooted in this most culturally influential of all stories. This is the wellspring of it. But also, I think, if Christians in the West want to de-Westernize, Christians need to remind in the West need to remind themselves of how strange what they believe is. It's so odd. It's so peculiar. It's so haunting. And that sense of the strangeness, I think, is what is missing, perhaps, both in the churches and in the kind of the humanist, secular, agnostic world beyond, that nevertheless is just completely Christian in its assumptions and attitudes. And that, I think, is where the sufferings of Christians in countries beyond the West can help, whether you're Christian or not a Christian. The spectacle of people willing to suffer and perhaps to die for this story, I think, reanimates it with a sense of its primal strangeness. And I know that I don't need to tell any of you that, because you already know that. But I had to go to Iraq and kind of stare this darkness in the face before I properly appreciated it. And so that's why I'm very honoured to have been invited tonight. And I thank you once again for your invitation. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Hello, I'm Dave Landrum. I'm the Director of Advocacy at Open Doors. Nearly forgot then. That was, as Dominion, wide-ranging, but also very pointed. We've got time for some questions, and we've got some roaming mics, but because I'm asking the questions, I get to ask the first one. Thank you. The cover of The Atlantic this week had an image, a Reservoir Dogs image of Putin, Xi Jinping, Erdogan, Modi in India, and the title of the cover was "The Bad Guys Are Winning." And it seems that we're entering an era of diminishing human rights and religious freedom around the world. How do we? A part of what Open Doors does is tell the story of what's happening to Christians around the world. And we give a reality check, I think, into Western Christian cultures. Are we seeing a return to business as usual, i.e. a sort of Roman context? I mean, would you say, that's a big question, following the trajectory of Dominion, or is there an opportunity for a reality check for Christians in the West?
I think that you mentioned Erdogan and you mentioned Modi, and I think that they're particularly interesting because they serve as a reminder to people in the West, whether they are Christian or more particularly not Christian, that Western values are not universal.
No.
They are contingent. They are bred of a particular cultural seedbed, which is deeply Christian. And in the case of Modi and in the case of Erdogan, it's clear that what they're reacting to is an understanding of society that the primacy of the West for kind of two centuries, its global primacy, has enabled people in the West to assume that concepts such as, for instance, the secular, the idea that there is a neutral space called the secular, and that there are things called religions which are separate and distinct from the secular, that this is something that everyone can accept. It's just kind of, you know, part of the way that everything is. But what Modi and Erdogan are doing is reminding us that there are actually very, very different ways of seeing the world, that this understanding of the secular and the religious is bred of, I mean, ultimately goes back, I suppose, ultimately to Jesus and the coin of Caesar, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, unto God what is God. It goes through Augustine, the city of God, the city of man, this idea that there are rival dimensions, the fallen world of the saeculum, the religio, the bond that joins the church to the timeless purity and eternity of heaven, that these are theological dimensions that in the 21st century, the theological quality of these concepts has been forgotten. And so we just assume that they're kind of sociological constants that everyone can share. But in India, that's not the case. The secularism that defines the Indian Republic is a legacy of the British period. And what Modi is doing is basically kind of trying to wash Hindu India of that kind of Western Christian British legacy. And likewise in Turkey, what Erdogan is trying to do is to get rid of the kind of the concept of secularism that Ataturk famously introduced. With Xi Jinping, China, of course, is a civilization older than that of Christendom. It has its own incredible reservoir of concepts of ways that society can be framed that owes nothing to the West. Putin's the interesting one because, of course, Putin rules the Third Rome. But it's a reminder of the way in which Latin Christendom has evolved in very different ways to Orthodox Christendom, and that the relationship between Caesar and Church in Byzantium and then in due course in Moscow took the course of Christianity in those realms on a rather different path that medieval Christianity and then the Reformation took the West. And I think it serves to remind us in the West not to be culturally arrogant about this.
So tell the church not to be culturally arrogant.
No, I think the church should be culturally arrogant because the church thinks it's all true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, if you think it's true, that you should be absolutely upfront about it. But I think that you should lay claim to it.
Lay claim to it. Yes. Be bolder.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good. Do we have some questions? We'll start with Gavin at the front here. Questions, not statements. We haven't got much time. Thank you.
I want to throw back to Tom a question he once asked me, but I'd like him to answer it. Tom, once we had a small discussion, and you said the very distinctive thing about the church was that, as you quite just said, it really does believe in good and evil. It's nothing if it doesn't have a metaphysical vision. Most of the people here, I think, would sign up to that metaphysics. One difficulty we have is persuading a highly secularized society that our metaphysical vision isn't something at the level of Victorian fairy tales. As someone who straddles both worlds, do you have any advice for us in the way in which we can reacquaint our society with the seriousness of what is almost a dualistic metaphysical narrative in order to catch their imagination sufficiently for us to be able to tell the Christian story with effect?
Well, I think the key is for people in the West to be culturally humble and to recognise that their values are not universal, as I said. So another one would obviously be human rights. Because the West has been so hegemonic for so long, it's been in a position to assume that its concept of human rights is somehow universal. They don't need to think about it. Of course human rights exist. But what the rise of China and of other civilizational powers is doing is to remind us that the concept of human rights is one that has emerged in a very specific cultural matrix, which is a Christian one. And that therefore, if you want to believe in human rights, you have to believe. It takes a leap of faith to believe that there are things called human rights, just as much as it takes a leap of faith to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ raised from the dead. They're both beliefs. And the fact that most people in the West sign up to the fact that human rights exist and that they're important and that they should determine, say, national policy, public policy, actually it's as rooted in theology and myth and metaphysics as all the teachings of Christianity. And I think that once people are reminded of that, I think it becomes impossible not to feel a kind of greater sense of where, what Christianity is about. Because, if you believe in human rights, why not believe that Jesus rose from the dead? You might as well hang for a sheep as a lamb. I think that it reminding people that the core beliefs that are fundamental to how people morally define themselves is rooted in faith, reopens the possibility for secularists to recognize that they are not somehow, they have not kind of emancipated themselves from the need for faith. They continue to illustrate it. And I think that kind of contemplating that then reopens the possibility to think, well, where might this practice of believing in fantastical things lead? But I think one of the things that the churches need to do is to kind of absolutely embrace this, rather than being slightly embarrassed about it and only talking about the kind of things that you'd hear on a Liberal Democrat Party political broadcast, which is a kind of, you know, thought for the day thing. I mean, I think that thought for the day and, you know, the kind of religious studies GCSE where you compare what Buddhists and Muslims think about smoking, that kind of stuff, I think it's absolutely destructive because it just kind of makes everything a mush. I think that the churches have to lay claim to everything that is kind of most, that is weirdest, most countercultural, most peculiar. You know, don't kind of duck all the stuff about angels and things. I mean, major on that because...
Great. Just to say, Tim Farron's a Liberal Democrat. He's at the back. He's a little bit upset by that. Wasn't directed at you, Tim. Can we take another question?
Well, Tim Farron is, you know, is an absolute example of someone who is both a Liberal Democrat and a practicing Christian, and the intersection point is absolutely clear, and he's never disguised the fact.
Yeah. Brilliant. Question there.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I was particularly fascinated by what you said about the cross and how the cross from the 5th century has emerged as the symbol. Aside from the fact that it, you know, it is an easy symbol to draw, to hold on to, why do you think, in all of your thinking and studying, that that became the symbol over say, the empty tomb? Or, you know, why the suffering saviour? Why that?
Because it's the weirdest thing. It's the weirdest thing. The idea that someone might rise from a place of death into heaven is not weird for the Romans or the Greeks. Heracles does it. Heracles is on his funeral pyre, and a chariot comes and takes him up to Olympus. And when Augustus, when his body is being burnt in the Campus Martius, and all the Roman people are gathered, a senator sees his soul rising up into the heaven. And after Caesar has been murdered, a comet is seen streaking across the sky. The idea that someone who was mortal has become divine and has risen up into heaven and has triumphed over death, it's odd. I mean, it's unusual. It's not something that happens all the time. But people do feel that, you know, well, okay, this does happen. But the idea that someone who has suffered this most humiliating of deaths, I mean, that's just off, you know, it's beyond the pale. That's so peculiar and weird that, you know, you just have to read Paul's letters in the consciousness of that. And he's writing as someone who's familiar both with the Jewish world and with the Greek world and the Roman world. And he knows that everyone he's saying this to, you know, to the Jews it's a stumbling block, to the Gentiles it's madness. He understands that there is no one for whom this isn't just deeply, deeply, kind of transcendently mad. And it's the madness of it that kind of becomes the point. And I know that, of course, that the heart of the Christian story for Christians is the resurrection, that without the resurrection, the cross is meaningless. You know, it's just a horrible death. But the horrible death is kind of... That's the strangeness for people in the world that Paul is going out into. Thanks.
You're listening to Unbelievable, a special New Year's edition of the show, broadcasting a lecture and Q&A given by historian Tom Holland in November this past year at the British Library. I had a small hand in helping to organise it, so it's great to be able to bring it to you today on the show. And we'll hear the final part of the Q&A in the final segment of today's show.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. A happy new year to you, a special New Year's edition of the show, bringing you a lecture by historian Tom Holland. Next week on the show, for the first show of 2022, two Aussies will be joining me. Dan Patterson is the founder of Questioning Christianity, a ministry connecting the Christian story to life's deepest questions. Dean Mays is a nurse working in an intensive care unit and the author of several acclaimed novels. Now, Dan's new book, Questioning Christianity, explores the nature and relevance of the Christian story. Dean is a show listener who's been drawn into a journey exploring God, faith and philosophy in recent years, and he'll be bringing his questions about Christianity to the conversation and asking whether the story of Christianity can make sense of our story. They'll particularly be looking at the issue of suffering as well next week, so look out for that on your podcast and on your video as well. Your feedback is coming up shortly, including the most listened to Unbelievable shows of 2021. And just a reminder that if you're able to give a year-end gift towards the work of Unbelievable, that's hugely appreciated. There's links for giving from the USA or indeed the UK and the rest of the world with today's podcast. Now back to the final part of the Q&A with historian Tom Holland, given at the British Library last November on Christianity, persecution and the cross.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm very struck by the way your whole discussion is hinging on the question of power. And it's particularly pertinent because I've just come from the General Synod of the Church of England. And it was a very interesting experience because the first morning of our 2 days was spent dressed up in funny clothes, which were often symbols of power and learning, parading around a very large building, which was an enormous symbol of power in Westminster Abbey. And then we come into this assembly and we talk about being humble being humbled and being simpler. And I think in the Church of England particularly, it's not quite so true for other churches in the UK, we've got this very strange paradox of having financial power. Church commissioners are sitting on £9 billion at the moment of assets. And we've got lots of buildings, which are symbols of power in the public space. And yet feeling very vulnerable and actually lacking cultural confidence in the face of trans ideology, in the face of the development of, you know, completely in Western contemporary culture, rethinking anthropology, what it means to be human and human identity. Do you think it's inevitable that we won't recover our confidence in our transcendent message until we're stripped of those external signs of power?
No, because everything about Christianity is a vast matrix of paradox. So, you know, the cross is the obvious example of that, the slave becomes the master and so on. But, of course, also inherent is the fact that the cross, you know, emblem of powerlessness, of Christ's kind of, you know, emptying himself. The cross also is a symbol of power. The reason that it's the most culturally recognised symbol is because it's been taken by people to the absolute ends of the earth. And so that paradox has been there right from the beginning. I mean, it's there in Paul saying, you know, there is no Jew or Greek. That is the idea that underlies everything in our society. The multicultural society, the idea that you know, there's no Jew or Greek, there's no black or white, there's no gay or straight, there's no cis or trans. That all are should be as one. But inherent in that no Jew or Greek is the problem of what you do with people who don't want to be part of this kind of universalist marsh, of whom the Jews are the obvious example, the Jews who don't follow Paul into a belief in Christ. And so that, you know, the church's relationship with the Jews has always been the kind of the dark shadow. And I just think that it's something with which the church has always had to wrestle. And I think specifically in the context of Western history, it's generated these kind of great ripple effects of revolution. In the 11th century, it's a revolution that targets the power of emperors and kings. In the 16th century, it's a revolution that targets the power of popes and cardinals. In the 18th century, it's a revolution that targets the very idea of the church. And I think that since the 60s, we've been moving through a very similar process of revolution, where some of the most fundamental assumptions and values of a Christian society are being questioned. But they're being questioned in Christian terms. Why why the emphasis on trans people who are an absolute minority of a minority? I think it's because they are seen as the ultimate victims. That gay people have attained the kind of dignity that gay campaigners have been campaigning for since the 60s and 70s. They've attained that. Trans people perhaps haven't. And so they embody a sense of victimhood that is deeply sacred to our society still. And I think that does make it difficult for Christians who have to kind of balance the fact that Christianity is simultaneously the most hegemonic way of explaining what humanity is for that has ever existed, but at the same time, obviously kind of privileges those who suffer. I mean, that's why Nietzsche hated it. And there is a kind of tension there, and there always has been, right from Paul writing his letter to the Galatians. It's always been there. And I don't think that there is an answer, there's no pat answer to that. It's a kind of process of praxis, I guess.
And paradox.
And paradox, yes.
Do we have time for one more question? One more? Can we have one more question somewhere? There's a hand waving over here. I've had hands waving at the hand over here, so we should take that one.
Thank you, Tom, for your lecture and your book. How would you respond to the sort of thinking non-Christian who says, I'm grateful for the ethical heritage and instinct, and I'll keep that and dispense with the rest of the Christian worldview?
Well, I think that keeping the Christian ethical perspective is still a form of faith. It's not obvious. Why not behave like a Nazi? Why not behave like Caesar? The instincts to take pleasure in power and to enjoy the spectacle of people's pain is very evident. I was kind of thinking this watching Squid Game, which is, I'm sure lots of you may have seen it, but I mean, it's actually, Christianity has, plays quite a sizable role in that, and it's a reminder of the way that Korea is quite a Christian country. But obviously not so Christian that people aren't getting off on watching people suffering horribly. And there's the kind of the way in which when Islamic State were doing their snuff videos, killing, beheading people and putting them on YouTube, apparently, for a week after that, the name of the person whose head had been chopped off would be one of the most Googled things across the world. So the idea that we've somehow, outgrown the Roman love of blood spectacle is simply not true. And I think that people just need to remember. I mean, everybody, who thinks that being agnostic and secular is somehow neutral needs to remind themselves that is simply not the case.
Yeah, thank you. Which is why we need historians like Tom Holland. Can you give him a round of applause, please?
Thanks again to Open Doors for permission to rebroadcast that lecture and Q&A with historian Tom Holland from the British Library earlier in the year. And if you want to find out more about the work of Open Doors UK and Ireland, go to their website opendoorsuk.org. If you'd like to get in touch with me to share your thoughts about today's lecture, then feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us on social media too, facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable for the show page. You can tweet me at UnbelievableJB or equally find me over on TikTok and Instagram as Justin.Brierley. Your thoughts welcome on today's show, but also, of course, with your thoughts for the coming year. Who would you like to see featured on the show? What topics? Always open to hearing about that. And don't forget, we've also got that survey. We want to know what topics and conversations you'd like to hear on The Big Conversation in 2022. Links are with today's show. It's great to know how many people are listening to Unbelievable over the past year. The show continues to grow, and I've got the 10 most downloaded podcasts of 2021 in front of me. I wonder what your favorite shows were, what the most engaging shows you thought were. Well, here is, in reverse order, the top 10 shows of 2021, according to the number of downloads they've received across the past year. Well, at number 10, CRT and Woke Christianity. Remember that debate back in October between Owen Strahan and Jermaine Marshall? Lots of people interested in that. Loads of feedback to that particular episode of the show. At number 9, right from the beginning of 2021, is the US church in the grip of political idolatry? Shane Claiborne and Johnny Moore were on that program. And that, of course, was directly in the wake of the Capitol Hill insurrection. So lots of people downloading that show to hear those two go at it. Kristin Cobes-Dumais came in at number 8. We had a live stream with her that we aired on the podcast that was talking about masculinity, Mark Driscoll, and the future for US evangelicals. That was in at number 8. Don't know if you're noticing a theme here, but these are all very much related to cultural and political issues in the USA. So 10, 9, and 8. Number 7, though, hot potatoes, cultural, theological issue. This was the egalitarian and complementarian discussion between Beth Allison Barr and Rachel Green Miller. That was in at number 7. Their views on biblical womanhood and so on. At number 6, Bishop Robert Barrett and Alex O'Connor, aka Cosmic Skeptic. This was the first of our big conversations, I think back in April. Christianity or atheism, which makes best sense of who we are, was what they were debating. At number 5, should Christians embrace the Enneagram? This was a really popular show. Todd Wilson in favour of the Enneagram, Marcia Montenegro against it. Loads of response to that show when we did that. So that was really interesting, because it's not that Todd or Marcia in themselves are particularly well known, but that subject really got your attention. So that was our fifth most popular show of the year. At number 4, another big conversation, this time N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray, Identity, Myth and Miracles. How do we live in a post-Christian world? That was a live stream conversation between them that we broadcast as one of our big conversation discussion series. And very popular again. In at number 3, our third most popular show of the year. This again was from earlier in the year, Transgender People and the Church. That was Preston Sprinkle and Christina Beardsley, who is transgender herself. And so that was a really interesting discussion, a very important discussion. And again, shows that these hot button issues tend to be the ones that people are most likely to engage with. At number 2, perhaps unsurprisingly, the Ravi Zacharias scandal. Dr. Diane Langberg, Glenn Scrivener, Steve Boffman and Ruth Jackson joined me for lessons we need to learn in the wake of the Ravi Zacharias scandal. That was our second most popular show of the year. I think back in February or March that we broadcast that one. And I was a little surprised at actually what came out top, the most downloaded show by podcast of Unbelievable over the past year. At number 1, Did Adam and Eve Exist? This was William Lane Craig and Joshua Swamidas. Very popular show. It was a great discussion between them based off William Lane Craig's latest book on the quest for the historical Adam. But that was our most downloaded show of 2021. Now, there's also been another very popular show recently with William Lane Craig, debating Calvinism and Molinism, of course, with James White. And that nearly made the top 10 already, though probably, you know, as the people continue to download the show as a relatively recent episode, I'm sure it will become one of the most popular of the year. But there you go. Those were the top shows that you've been listening to across the past year. You've also been watching on video, of course, as I said earlier on in the podcast. Lots of people subscribing to the Unbelievable YouTube channel. And here are the top 10 videos that you were watching throughout 2021, our most popular videos. Though these videos aren't all from 2021. In fact, some of them are a couple of years old, but still lots of people choosing to watch them. At number 10 was a short clip, actually, from one of our big conversations between Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams. Did Jesus Claim to Be God? And that had over 100,000 views in 2021. The Ravi Scandal, one of our top podcast shows was at number 9. That was with, again, Diane Langberg, Steve Boffman, Glenn Scrivener, and Ruth Jackson. My own thoughts on the Ravi Zacharias scandal came in at number 8. I didn't want it to be true, and that's the problem, was the title of one of the videos I made around that time in February. So again, that was pretty popular. At number 7, another big conversation, but from a previous season, Glenn Scrivener and Matt Dillahunty debating, can atheism deliver a better world? At number 6, a classic debate between John Lennox and Peter Atkins, can science explain everything? That was actually broadcast first in 2019. But our 6th most popular video. So Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig, the universe, how did it get here and why we're part of it? Again, part of a previous big conversation season, but a very popular video in the past year. And then at number 4, William Lane Craig versus James White, Calvinism and Molinism. That has made it into our top 10 for the most popular videos from the past year. At number 3, our big conversation from this year between Bishop Robert Barron and Alex O'Connor. At number 2... it's a clip from our most popular ever video. This is Jordan Peterson debates atheist Susan Blackmore, who says life is meaningless. That had over 500,000 views in 2021, which goes to show why the most popular video, and it has been for the last few years, continues to be Jordan Peterson versus Susan Blackmore, the full show of their big conversation. Do we need God to make sense of life? That's had over 3 million views altogether, but in the past year had over 800,000. So a lot of people finding Unbelievable because of that classic debate between Peterson and Susan Blackmore. So whether you've been watching or listening via podcast and radio, thank you so much for supporting Unbelievable in the past year. And by the way, if you'd like to support us and help us to make more of this content, we do have an end of year giving campaign. Your gift makes a huge difference to us. And you can find links from today's show from wherever you are in the world, USA or UK and the rest of the world. There's a way to give and support the show into 2022. Thanks so much for being part of Unbelievable. Okay, let's go to some of your feedback to the last several weeks of programming. It's always good to hear from people, whoever they are and whatever they're going through in life. I've saved this one for today. This is an anonymous person who got in touch a few months ago. Very unusual situation. They were getting in touch on the back of a classic replay we did on sexuality. But their story, yeah, I just thought I'd read this and see what you make of it. This person gets in touch to say, I love this show. Find it really encouraging hearing that others ask the kinds of questions that I also do. Sometimes I worry and feel that I'm a rubbish Christian because of my doubts and stuff. But actually, some of my thoughts are thoughts that many of us have. And it's interesting and thought-provoking to hear different perspectives on tough questions. I actually felt deeply saddened upon hearing the internal battles of both the Christians who were involved in the ex-gay versus gay-affirming dialogue that came out on the classic replay back in August. Most especially one of them making the decision to marry a woman despite his feelings not changing. I greatly respect this, but admittedly don't fully understand the choice. I felt heartbroken for the woman, knowing that her husband would never really love her, and for the man having to battle with homosexual thoughts day in and day out, aching to be attracted to his own wife. I can't imagine the pain of that, and I commend him for his faithfulness and pray that as a couple they will be a strong force for Jesus and find a newfound love for each other. On another note, I wanted to mention that on hearing this particular story, I felt empathy in that I understood to some degree the struggle of not being able to outwardly express who you truly love, although of course not to the same degree. Now, this may sound nonsensical, but bear with me. A few years ago, I was completely enamoured and obsessed with a particular cartoon character. I felt deeply in love with him and fantasised our relationship to the point that I truly felt we were together. The relationship was damaging to my life and I had to make the decision to end it, one of the hardest things I ever had to do. This is where I could empathise with your guest when he had to break up with his male partner at the time. It still comes back to haunt me now, occasionally, though not as strongly. I sometimes still find my mind slipping back into thinking of him, and it's difficult to take my mind back to reality. It hurts sometimes. I've researched online and found that this phenomenon is not singular to me. It is, in fact, shared by many others. I've scrolled through forums of people in love with fictional characters of all kinds, as well as reading stories of people in love with objects. I'm sure you've heard of the famous tale of the woman who married the Eiffel Tower. There doesn't appear, however, to be much in the way of Christian advice or support for those struggling with this, and certainly I myself have had nobody I felt able to share with for fear of being looked upon as a complete weirdo. Perhaps this could be a future discussion on your show. What do people think about it and how to tackle it from a Christian perspective? God bless. Well, thank you, anonymous listener. One of the more unusual, you know, issues that I've ever heard of, and I can't claim to be know anything really about this particular phenomenon that you talk about. If anyone's listening and has any thoughts anywhere that I could direct this listener to when it comes to this particular sort of issue, I would love to know about it. Again, not something I've ever really bumped into before, but obviously that is a psychological issue for some people. Thanks for getting in touch. Good to hear from you. Glad you found the show helpful and that particular episode helped you to kind of come to terms with some of what you've been dealing with there. Let's go back a little way. I've still got lots of sort of old emails in the email bag that have never been sort of read out on the show in relation to various shows of the past. As I say, one of the most popular, as we heard, has been our CRT debate between Owen Strahan and Jermaine Marshall, and still plenty of responses to that show that haven't been read out before. So I'm gonna read a few of these. Andrew Parker gets in touch to say, as usual, I'm behind on Unbelievable and recently listened to the conversation between Owen Strahan and Jermaine Marshall. Well, I must say it was lively. Happily, they kept it civil because it could have gone somewhere else otherwise. Those two are probably as close to being on opposite ends of the spectrum on the subject matter as any two Christian guests ever have been. Perhaps I'm hyperbolizing. For almost the entire time, I heard two people mostly talking past one another. You valiantly tried to get them to communicate better, but it was to little avail. I heard some good points from both, and I heard what I considered absurdities from both. Ultimately, though, they really only seemed to begin communicating with each other during the last 10 minutes or so. Pity, but nonetheless, I doubt those two would ever have come to a meeting of minds on much of anything, given many hours to talk. As such, I think the audience was mostly left unedified. If you came in leaning strongly one way or the other, you probably left even more convinced of the position you started with. I suspect it might be pretty hard to find two guests to have another discussion on the same topic of CRT, but if you could find two who were willing to look towards one another rather than just lecture one another on how they're completely wrong, it might be quite fruitful. To me, however, these two gentlemen came across merely citing the polarized tropes that are common to our era. It would be nice to hear from two people who were actually doing some reconciliation work, but coming from different parts of the spectrum. People who could both recognize that, yes, there are still problems we haven't resolved, but much progress has been made, and that the fault for what is still lacking isn't monolithically on one side or the other. People who could recognize that such things as redlining and police brutality really do still occur, but that phrases such as white privilege aren't particularly helpful, since the people who need to hear you the most shut their ears when they hear it. I have no one to nominate for this discussion, but I think it'd be great if you could find them. But when one guest seems oblivious to possible lingering structural problems, while the other seems pretty wedded to forced reparations, we'll never get anywhere, because both of those perspectives just ignore the lived experiences of people on the other side. People like that make no progress towards reconciliation. I find it interesting that neither man, to my recollection, ever used the word reconciliation. And if there's anything the real gospel is all about, surely it's reconciliation. First of all with God, and then with other people. And thanks, by the way, for putting the pin back into the grenade that Jermaine lobbed out there when he said he approached Paul with suspicion. Hoo boy, that could have certainly gotten Owen's blood boiling pretty quickly. Of course, what he said was a great indicator of why Owen and Jermaine were never going to get even close to reconciling their positions, because approaching Paul with suspicion is a non-starter for so many, many of us, such as myself, and obviously including Owen. Anyway, I've waxed on long enough. Do hope you might be able to find two guests who could help point us in the direction of reconciliation. Thank you. That's Andrew Parker in North Richland Hills, Texas. Daniel David in Michigan also got in touch about it to say, I was taken aback by hearing Mr. Strahan describe his visceral reaction to the suggestion that his friend, who had adopted black children, could also be a racist, as if that precluded the matter. I, a white man, have also adopted three black boys, but it is through my experience as a long-haul foster parent, having attended many fostering conferences and support groups, that I can tell you that racists can and do foster and adopt children of colour. Unfortunately, this seemingly contradictory condition comes mainly from the Christian contingent of our community and the white saviour complex that exists within it. There are always the people who buck against family reunification, which should be the ideal goal of foster parenting. They often segregate themselves into groups to endlessly rail and plot against their birth parents and congratulate themselves on their selflessness. It is no hyperbole to say they consider themselves saviours. When coupled with the admixture of politics and religion here in the States, Christians considering these children as needing to be saved, not just from family dysfunction, but from the culture of their parents and communities, do not represent racial reconciliation in any meaningful way. So Mr. Strand's outrage is indicative of the self-righteousness that blinds these Christians to the racism inherent in their projects. That's from Daniel Davis in Michigan. And finally, on this show from earlier in the year, Zach Tronstad says he's a big fan of the show, discovered it over quarantine, and it's really helped me grow in my faith. I know I'm late in responding to this CRT episode between Owen and Jermaine, but there was something that bothered me about the discussion and took me a while to figure out what it was. There were points from both Owen and Jermaine I agreed with and points from both I disagreed with, but I felt an inability to form a nuanced opinion. Both, while passionate, were unwilling to cede any point to the other side, which made the discussion feel more like both sides grandstanding. Ultimately, I think this debate was a microcosm of a big problem the church here in America is undergoing. We've become more defined by the cultural and social issues we support rather than being defined by our identity in Christ. Our identity in Christ should make the global church a place where we can have discussions about complex social issues and feel the room to ask legitimate questions about both sides of the issue. We may not agree on the topic, but actively seeking to understand the other side is a great way to show the rest of the world that unity in Christ is greater than the increasingly polarized and divided culture we're living in. When Christians have a discussion like this, I think a respectful approach that recognizes our deep commonality in the Lord Jesus would be a beacon of light to the world around us. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much for you and the whole team keeping these discussions coming. Thank you, Zach, and thanks for everyone who's been in touch with their comments on various shows over the past year. It's great to have you with us in 2021 and looking forward to all that we can do in 2022 to bring you more conversations that matter. Again, if you want to send in your thoughts for topics or guests, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, you can find more from the show at our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But we'll have a new webpage to tell you about soon in 2022. We've got grand plans for Premier Unbelievable, as we're calling it, which will be the umbrella for all of the different resources and podcasts that we're going to be bringing you in the coming year, and a new website to tell you about very, very soon. For now, thanks for being with us. And if you are able to make a gift, an end of year gift towards Unbelievable and to continue this work strong into 2022, well, the links are with today's show. Right now, let me tell you what's coming up next week. It's going to be our first show of 2022, and two Aussies join me, Dan Patterson and Dean Mays. Dan is the founder of Questioning Christianity. Dean is a nurse working in intensive care. Now, Dan's new book, Questioning Christianity, explores the nature and relevance of the Christian story. Dean is a show listener who's been drawn from atheism towards a journey exploring God, faith and philosophy in recent years, partly as a result of bumping into Unbelievable. He's got questions, though, about Christianity, particularly around the issue of suffering. He's seen so much of it in the intensive care units he's been part of. But he's got a really fascinating story, too. Dan and Dean join me on the show next week. Hope you can be there, too. For now, thanks for being with us and have a very happy new year.